Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Haiti faces a political, sociological, and economic set of crises. But international intervention has done little to help the nation. And in fact, it has exacerbated the problems. How can the nation thrive in light of a history of exploitation and colonialism that has led to these crises? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Last month, the terms of Haiti's last 10 remaining senators officially expired, leaving this Caribbean country without a single elected government official as it faces a set of intersecting catastrophes: famine, cholera, gang violence, fuel shortages, and economic collapse. Haiti has not held functional elections since 2019, and the country has been in a fragile state since the 2010 earthquake that killed up to 300,000 people. But the assassination of Jovenel Moise in July 2021, coupled with a new earthquake and a tropical storm later that summer, really has sent the situation spiraling out of control. And a gang coalition blockaded the main port and fuel terminal after the government cut fuel subsidies. Add to that that Haiti is faced with perhaps its worst ever famine, with the UN reporting that as many as 4.7 million people are facing acute hunger. On today's show, we examine how Haiti has fallen into this deep political economic crisis, the historic roots of that crisis, and evaluate some of the different proposals, including the U.S.'s proposal for an international intervention to address the nation's needs. Our panel today is Darlene Dubuisson. She is professor of anthropology at the University of Pittsburgh, and she's the author of Haiti, Black Utopia, and We Know How to Work Together, Convite, Protest, and the Rejection of the INGO Bureaucratic Dominance. Mark Schuller is presidential research professor and professor of anthropology and nonprofit and NGO studies at Northern Illinois University. He is the author of Humanitarian Aftershocks in Haiti and Killing with Kindness, Haiti, International Aid, and NGOs. And Jean-Eddy Sepal is professor of sociology at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. He is the author of Assassinations and Invasions, How the U.S. and France Shaped Haiti's Long History of Political Turmoil, and Between Two Worlds, John Price Mars, Haiti and Africa. Thank you all very much for joining us. This case does not get nearly enough press coverage in the U.S. and has long, deep historical roots, as well as, of course, some of the acute challenges that it faces. And so, Professor Saint-Paul, what are the roots? What's the current status of the politics of society, the economy in Haiti today?
Thank you for the invitation. It's a great pleasure to share space with my colleagues, Professor Dubuisson and Professor Schuller. I like the way you introduce the topic because you touch on some contemporary issues that Haiti has been facing. You mentioned, for instance, the cholera, right? So you mentioned the assassination of the former president Jovenel Moïse, you mentioned the earthquake. So, and if we just take those most contemporary events, we can see that those contemporary problems, they are connected to contemporary political practice that are rooted, that are anchored in Western imperialism and more particularly U.S. imperialism. For instance, let's try to break them down quickly. If we take the cholera, Haiti is a country that had more than 100 years without any history whatsoever of cholera. The cholera was brought to Haiti by Nepalese soldiers from the United Nations Mission for the Stabilization of Haiti, a mission, this called MUNISTA, for its acronym in French, because in French, is la mission des Nations Unies pour la stabilisation d'Haïti. And that mission is a UN mission that was deployed in Haiti after February 29, 2004. And what happened in February 29, 2004? We had a sitting president that was democratically elected by the Haitian people. His name is Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The guy is still living. And because Jean-Bertrand Aristide, in 2003, in a public speech, he asked the French government to pay restitution and reparation for the money that the international community under the guise of the United States of America coerced the Haitian people to pay. So in an alliance between French government and the American, the US government, they overthrown Jean-Bertrand Aristide and they deployed the minister in Haiti with the mission to stabilize Haiti. Minister spent many years in Haiti from 2004 to 2017. And it was one soldier of the minister who brought cholera in Haiti. In Haiti, we have civil society. The civil society is not the strongest civil society on earth, but we do have actors fighting for Haiti's sovereignty, for the dignity of Haitian people, from the civil society. So the civil society, they complain against those malpractice of the United Nations. Back then, the chief of the United Nations was Ban Ki-moon. So Ban Ki-moon promised to give reparation to the victim and the family of those victims. And until today, we are talking, there is no reparation whatsoever. This is one thing. So we cannot understand what is happening in Haiti if we do not touch on those factors. Second, the earthquake of 2010. The earthquake of 2010 happened. Back then, the sitting president of the US was Barack Hussein Obama. So Barack Hussein Obama voiced to be the first Black president. So Barack Hussein Obama never traveled to Haiti. This is not my business. He never traveled to Haiti. But what he did, he gave the sovereignty of Haiti to the Clinton. Back then, Hillary Rodham Clinton was the U.S. Secretary of State. And Bill Clinton was sent to Haiti as the special envoy to oversee the reconstruction of Haiti. The same program that Joe Biden has now, Build Back and Better. So Bill Clinton went to Haiti with the slogan Build Back and Better. Through the Clinton Foundation, many million was raised, and that million never was used for the reconstruction of Haiti. So I give you those two contemporary examples in order to understand that we cannot understand a Haiti current predicament without understanding the malpractice, the noxious dimension of U.S. foreign policy in Haiti. So the minister was one of the most recent U.S. intervention in Haiti. After minister, we had, you know, the Office of Nation in Haiti. It's called BUNI for its acronym in French because it's the Bureau des Nations Unies in Haiti. From 2017 to now, we have the BUNI in Haiti. So, it was under the mission of the BUNI was to help Haiti to strengthen its judicial system, etc., etc. Under those United Nations entities, the situation of Haiti has been worsened. So this is the situation Haitian people has been dealing with. So we have people from the civil society. You have scholars outside Haiti organized to ask for the sovereignty, to ask the U.S. to give a chance to Haitian people to foresee their own future. But U.S. imperialism doesn't want that to Haiti.
to synopsize, Haiti, when it gained its independence, was probably the wealthiest, you know, country, certainly in the region, one of the wealthiest countries, and now is being described such an impoverished country. And, you know, as you highlighted, this isn't by accident, and it isn't by mismanagement on the part of Haitians. A lot of this has to do with international interventions, imperialism, colonialism. And Mark Schuller, since the initial interventions, that initial, but most recent ones, 1994, with the returning of power of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and of course, you know, other interventions, the tendency has been to use NGOs. A lot of times we talk about the way in which states contract their policies to NGOs. So first, why is it so popular to use NGOs to carry out their missions? And what is the practical effect of using all these different NGOs?
Thank you for the question and the invitation, Greg, just share a panel with such great colleagues. So the NGO situation in Haiti is called An Invasion by Haitian Scholars. So Robert Perrotin wrote a book, 97, The Invasion of NGOs. And what defines the more radical position, Jean-Louis Gist, his work is on NGOs. His last book published in 2009 was about which government are you? Jean-Louis Gist discusses the, he was murdered minutes before the earthquake, actually. Lots of specific parallels between the situation that led to his murder and the actual earthquake. But he mentioned in his book, Which Government Are You? 2009, Qui Gouvernement Oye, that the NGOs started coming to Haiti as a sort of a quid pro quo to get the United States to support the transfer of power between Francois and his son, Jean-Claude Duvalier, because Duvalier was afraid that the exiles would return to Haiti. So U.S. military was trained to keep people out of Haity. It's, you know, Dr. Durisson could talk about the work that's happening now about the U.S. preventing people from coming to the United States from Haiti. But that back then it was the reverse. Nelson Rockefeller, future vice president, was the envoy. He negotiated in return for the U.S. support for the transition of power, the two things, lowering the barriers to free trade and for, certainly to United States agribusiness interests. And second, for missionary groups and other NGOs to come to Haiti. So that's 1969 meeting, sort of to unravel whatever people can say about the Duvalier regime. It was nationalist. It wasn't explicitly under the thumb of US imperialists. They were more thought of as allies. But also Haiti democratized. The US intervened to prevent a coup d'etat, to prevent a popular uprising to remove Duvalier in 1986. And so they installed the military junta, the CNG, to explicitly do Washington's bidding. And that was how NGOs got to be more installed. I mean, the period between 86 and 1990, when RSD was elected the first time, you saw another big jump in NGOs. And you have, at that time, you have NGOs basically replacing the state. At the time in 86, 87, this was also when NGOs were dominant in the world. Neoliberal economic policy distrust strong central states. And so they had these parallel structures that they can control, in order they have the belief that the NGOs are closer to the people, less prone to things like corruption than states. So that's why, so Haiti was at the wrong place at the wrong time, if you could say, for the ascendancy of neoliberalism and ascendancy of NGOs as a structure. So what is the impact? You have people not believing that the Haitian government has any responsibility at all, because you have, you turn rights to, like the Haitian Constitution 87 guarantees the right to education, other sorts of rights in a social democracy, education, housing, basic needs, and you turn these rights into the state owes the population as citizens into gifts that foreigners give. So it reproduces this neocolonial relationship. The very basic level, that it reduces people's demands for justice into, you know, begging, essentially. Throw on top of that, explicitly neocolonial relationship to get the United States to, for the United States to resume its strength, or what they called influence in the region that was eroded before the 2010 earthquake. I have a position paper published 2 days after the earthquake that says, wonderful opportunity to reinstate U.S. Hegemony in the region. And so you had the U.S. military explicitly prevent French NGOs from coming to the country while allowing 20-somethings to go from the United States as missionaries and to to basically steal children as orphans. And the other impact long-term is aid divided families, it disrupted solidarity, it created new leaders, which were in conflict with the old, and it it increased violence against women, that kind of perverse policies that were maybe well-intentioned, second wave feminist women in development policies that encourage food aid to go to women. When you don't change the power structure and you basically create mini-me's where you have NGOs create camp committees and give them all kinds of power, the kind of people that are gravitate to those positions are missionaries or beneficiaries of the missionaries, and or people that would now today be under the same brush or painted in the same brush is called gangs are the ones making decisions, and they're all invariably men. So you produce the condition of transactional sex and rape and violence against women. And then this is deliberate structures that were created, and policies that did produce these outcomes. And so, I don't like to call it, unintended consequences. These are consequences of a humanitarian system that is, explicitly Western and, reproducing cultural norms in the United States. So these kinds of perverse impacts.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the ongoing political, economic crises in Haiti. Our guests today are Darlene Dubuisson of the University of Pittsburgh, Mark Schuller of Northern Illinois University, and Jean-Eddie Sepal of Brooklyn College, the City University of New York. And Professor Dubuisson, I want to bring you into the conversation here. One of the challenges of NGOs has always been, one of the attractions is that they weren't political. They're supposed to be just focused on technical expertise without too much regard for partisan politics. On another level, though, they're not political, meaning they're not answerable to the people that they're delivering the aid to. That in a democratic governance, the government isn't doing a good job. You can replace that government with another government that would do a better job. What we've been describing here with Haiti is the policies implemented, resources possibly delivered, et cetera. But we haven't really talked much about the Haitian people and their ability to frame that. I know you've written about ways in which Haitians have resisted this. First of all, what has been the Haitian people's reaction to this NGO dominance? And what really is kind of a democracy deficit?
Thank you, Doug, for the question. It's well put. And thanks again for the invitation. I would say that the Haitian response to NGOs is like the response of any heterogeneous population is not the same. My work has spanned working with what we call in Haiti paysans. The rough translation is peasants, but it doesn't have the same connotation as peasants does in the United States. So it's not the Marxist peasants that don't organize or et cetera. Paysan in Haiti has a strong political connotation. And a lot of times it is related to this kind of Freirean, Paulo Freirean idea of decolonizing in terms of understanding the use of land as related to long processes of neocolonialism and this kind of pedagogy of the oppressed model. So you have throughout Haiti's histories, paysans, even from the moment immediately after independence, right, being suspicious of the state, This is before we talk about NGOs. We're talking about the immediate post-independent moment, particularly as Haiti splits, right, between the North and the South. And Paysan also, the kind of political self-identity is rooted in systems of resistance from the colonial moment. This ability to be able to have independence by growing your own food, right? And this, the notion of laku, this kind of shared space, and the idea of shared labor. So paysan as an identity has been anti-capitalist and very suspect of state. With the work of paysan presently, NGOs are oftentimes understood as a form of the state, exercising similar means of domination. And I'll give an example. Paysan have been mobilized, for lack of a better word, in participant development schemes. I'll say schemes intentionally here. One of the ones that comes to mind, and this we can say is before the rise of neoliberalism in its current form, is the is under U.S. occupation, and it is essentially what we call code rural. That was a version under Boyer, but under U.S. occupation, paysan were charged to build infrastructure without pay. This gets replicated by NGOs in what is called food for work programs. So if we're talking about the paysan, there are skeptical of state and state-like actors, of which the ones I've worked with, understand NGOs, but there's also strategic alliances that happen. This sense that I can use the resources that you provide to my own ends, and I could play the game, if you will. But always understanding that, or approaching these states and state-like actors critically. Now, if we talk about in my work too, my work on intellectuals and professional class, there's also this NGO class an NGO class in mainly Port-au-Prince, a lot of individuals who are educated abroad who fill the positions of local NGO workers. And they might have a different perspective of this type of work, but also reading it strategically, in the sense that this provides an avenue for stable work as opposed to working for the state. They might also work for the state as well. The critique is there, but it is also informed by a sort of complicity with power. And it's deeply contradictory in that I worked with intellectuals who mobilized the paysan who work for NGOs and critique NGOs simultaneously. So to say all that is really to sum up is that a lot of folks within this kind of neoliberal condition, this kind of notion of scarcity and individualism, this idea of, and the need to be able to provide for oneself, there's a lot of contradiction that emerges. And that doesn't eliminate critique, but there is a sense of complicity at both levels of the paysan on one end and the NGO class, this idea of this upwardly mobile middle class, usually educated abroad, who find contract work or more stable work through NGOs. And it is complicated, but the critique, I would say, has, as far as I am concerned, has always been there. And it is a critique of the state and what Dr. Shula calls the parastate. And I don't think that individuals read NGOs as apolitical. I've not come across that, even if NGOs claim to be apolitical.
And Professor Dubuisson, if I can just follow up quickly, you're talking about this sentiment, this way of viewing the state. You're not just talking about a Haitian skepticism about international actors, right? You're also talking about even domestically, you know, within the state itself, which could help to explain why the Haitian state, one of many reasons why the Haitian state might have been struggling with being able to provide services to a population that begins pretty skeptical towards them. Is that correct?
Yeah. And then one thing I write about in my upcoming book, Reclaiming Haiti's Futures, is that the skepticism against the state had to do with the fact that after independence, the state was still the state, the Haitian state, the Haitian government was very much still enmeshed in colonial logics that produced the paysan into the mounadeyo, the outsiders. And you have what I call these colonial fissures. You have this initial rupture that begins to become solidified in the state apparatus itself. Divisions that are gendered, that are color, that are class, that are language, that penetrate the state in ways that become apparent, right? And throughout history, there have been moments of coming together, certainly. And also there's this kind of re-hemorrhaging, if you will. And so if you look at Haitian history, it's not simply one of division or distrust of the state, but there's also this engagement with this possibility of suturing colonial divisions.
When we come back, given these challenges that Haiti faces, what is the best way to respond? How can the Haitian people be empowered to seize control of their own destiny? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We've been discussing the current state of Haiti, the economic crisis, a country that faces mass famine, with an estimated 4.7 million people facing acute hunger. With the assassination of its president, Haiti is also facing a political crisis. Officials governing the country are having a legitimacy crisis, given the poor response to the previous crises that have seen the Haitian people lose power, authority, even sovereignty over the nation. What can be done? Doug Becker explores.
Our guests today are Darlene Dubuisson. She's a professor of anthropology at the University of Pittsburgh. Mark Schuller, presidential research professor and professor of anthropology and nonprofit and NGO studies at Northern Illinois University. And Jean-Eddie Sepal, professor of sociology at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. So the United States has proposed some sort of intervention, perhaps a UN military intervention, perhaps economic intervention, you know, at this point. And I suspect the Biden administration's motivation has much more to do with Haitian refugees than has to do with a concern for the Haitian state. But Professor Sampal, I will turn to you to this question because you've focused on the way in which Haiti's been deprived of their sovereignty. So what's the best path forward and how can international actors work with Haiti so that Haiti can regain its sovereignty, its power to make these decisions to improve conditions in the nation?
Yes, thank you, Doug, for the question. And let me be clear, and I will just add on what Professor Schuller said. We cannot have the sovereignty if there is no Leviathan in Haiti. And the NGO jobs because it's important also, Doug, to share the data with your audience. When the political transition of Haiti started in 1986, so myself, I was in Haiti. I was born in Haiti. I went to school in Haiti, and I attended college in Haiti. Yes, of course, as Professor Dubuisson said, the Haitian state was never a state at the service of the citizenship, and there is important scholarship on this topic. The Haitian anthropologist Michel Wolf-Trouillot published a book, The State Against the Nation. There is a new book that is just published by Professor Philippe Richard Maris that portrayed the Haitian state, the post-colonial state, as a liberal bourgeois state, okay? So the state of Haiti was never a very all-inclusive state to foster citizenship to the dignity of Haitian people. That has been a fact, historic fact. But it has been a state that has been able to offer a minimum set of services to the Haitian people. Myself, I am a product of the Haitian educational system. I am a son of paysan. My dad was a paysan. I can say that I am a paysan, although when I was born, my birth certificate said paysan. So we are talking about identity. Yes, I am a paysan because my birth certificate say I am a paysan. But Doug, let's take just an example. I was born in Lekai, in the south of Haiti. Lekai, because of its, configuration, location, is very fragile when it comes to, natural disaster. So I experienced in my childhood, many natural disaster. But back then in the 1980s, so we didn't have yet that invasion of NGO. So the paysan in my neighborhood, in my town, they didn't expect aid from the international community. Something happened and they rebuild their own community by themselves. But it's by 1985 when Ronald Reagan started the CBI, the Caribbean Basin Initiative. So, and Haiti will experience, the neoliberalization of economy. So they destroy, undermine agriculture, etc. All those problems of Haiti will worsen. Yes, of course, historically there has been a problem in Haiti, but there has been a minimum of Leviathan. So in between 1957 and until 1986, so I grew up on the Duvalier, on Baby Doc, on Jean-Claude Duvalier, but school were working, right? So, but now they gave the NGO the job of the state. And as Max Schuller and Professor Dubuisson said, that is something that is part of the design, because politics requires a design. It has to be the design of the way the international community want to portray and have Haiti as a state. Because Haiti is more than Haiti. Haiti historically always for all Black people, for all the oppressed of the global South. So having a state with the capacity to put in place structure and provide services that will empower many other nations. And the neo-colonial and imperial logic doesn't want that happen. And in closing, I published an article in which I use the theoretical framework of Joel S. Migdal. Joel S. Migdal, who is a professor of political science here in the United States of America, he developed what he called the theory of social forces. So, and Joel S. Migdal explained that is not necessarily true that every state who want to have a Leviathan can have that Leviathan. In front of the Haitian state, there has been always actors who have been actively working to challenge the sovereignty of the Haitian state. And only change paradigm, so I don't see, you know, where the solution of Haiti will come. Because to have Haiti sovereignty requires security. But we have the National Police of Haiti. That National Police was not created by Haitian people. The National Police of Haiti is an institution created by the U.S. Department of Justice, funded through a program that is called ICTAP. So all the institutions we have in Haiti, so all those institutions receive funding, and the U.S. has always been actively engaged in what they call the USAID, U.S. Aid for Development of Haiti. So USAID, we have to interrogate the USAID in Haiti. So until, as I said at the beginning of the show, until the U.S. is willing to have his boot up the neck of Haiti, I don't see the way that Haitian people will recover their sovereignty. This is a good question, and there is no easy answer for that. And in closing, I just wanted to nuance the idea when you say, Doug, that Haiti was the wealthiest country in Western Hemisphere. I would nuance because when Haiti, when the place was wealthy, it was not Haiti, it was Saint-Domingue, and the wealth of the place was the wealth of the French people. It was not Haiti, so Haitian people didn't enjoy that wealth. Okay, just a historical, a nuance of concept. It was Haiti, it was Saint-Domingue that was the wealthiest country in the Caribbean, not Haiti, because Haiti was born in 1804.
Important corrective. Thank you. So, Mark Schuller, the U.S. has this motivation for intervention. I believe it's primarily driven by concerns about Haitian refugees. The fact that Haiti was listed by President Biden as one of the countries specifically singled out to go through the proper procedures rather than just sort of showing up on the border, et cetera. So overwhelmingly, I think the U.S. feels this, the Biden administration at least, feels compelled to do something. But we know that the NGO community has had this negative, if not profoundly negative, impact and this loss of sovereignty. I'll add that we haven't brought out here the accusations that in 2004, the NGOs literally overthrew the government and replaced Aristide in 2004 with a leader that they found more attractive. Is there the ability to reform the way NGOs are working? Or is it just the system is set up in such a way where the only real option is, in particular, American-based NGOs, the so-called, you know, the Republic of the NGOs of K Street, that they just should not have a place in a future Haiti? Is reform possible, or is this so sullied that really the best thing for the Haitian people is that the NGOs stay out?
Embedded in your question is a set of binaries that we need to, like, acknowledge. That 2004 was a coup, and people are finally calling it that, but it also wasn't a popular uprising. And the NGOs were instrumental in delivering the U.S. Foreign policy, but it was a lot more complicated. You know, there needs to be space for a tripartite analysis. The truth isn't in the middle. I mean, you have a Haitian state that the Haitian people demand accountability for as well. So I think we need to acknowledge that, yes, the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, was actively funding and fomenting the opposition to Aristide using NDI, the National Democratic Institute, and the International Republican Institute, IRI. Both political parties were bugged by Aristide. It was France that called for Aristide's head first because of as Dr. St. Paul said, it was the demand for reparations, and that would trigger a cascade of their own DOM, the Department the Utapemero, it would destabilize, you know, the foundations of Western white supremacy and Western, you know, and racial capitalism. So Biden administration is taking a free ride on Trump administration, hiding behind the Trump administration's explicitly racist Title 42 to exclude Haitian people from coming to the United States. But it was Biden that expelled more than 20,000 people in this first year, which is as much as the previous 20 years over three U.S. presidential terms combined. You know, Biden he kicked off Obama for the title of deporter in chief. So to think about this as, you know, bipartisan, you know, interest in containment. So the U.S. intervention is multifaceted. The desire to intervene, it's about, you know, comes out of electoral politics. The Haitians and other African-American and other Black voters in Florida could not deliver Florida to the Democrats. And I think that Florida's role as kingmaker in the United States is I think it's challenged now. Other states are in play. But I think it's real specifically, you know, what is the interest in U.S. intervention in Haiti? So it is long-term, the long journey. It is about assuring that African Americans and other Blacks don't follow the Haitian example of independence. I think it's about specifically being the dumping ground for U.S. agribusiness, and it's about keeping the laborers as fearful as possible to accept as lowest wage as possible to benefit U.S. textile manufacturing. But the complication, you know, is such that we can't treat Haiti as like a this is what U.S. policy about Haiti is, because U.S. policy toward Haiti is fragmented and it is white supremacist and it is imperialist, but it is also attuned to appearances. So the Democrats talk a game about human rights that I think we need to unpack. But the talk about human rights allows there to be social movement pressure to get more, you know, to actually follow up on your promises and fulfill them. But is reform possible, and is it worse, you know, like, again, like, if you were in Haiti now, you're confronting a gallon of gas costing $30, not having drinking water, having police officers being killed by armed irregular groups that were empowered by the former president in response to the massive outpouring of support for the question, you know, demanding accountability of the question of where did the money for Petrocaribe go? So the president Moïse he lost any kind of popular base that he had, and he was cornered. And the U.S. government continues to support the unelected who is implicated in the assassination of President Moïse. You know, that's that the blood is on the United States. It's on Biden's hands. So in a condition where people cannot go to school, can't go to work, people they can't get their groceries, that goods can't leave the capital because the people don't people in control of the streets don't want it, or because the cost of gas is prohibitive because the people that wanted to control the port don't want it. I think to pose the question of is reform possible, or, you know, is it better, is NGO presence better than nothing? I think we need to really ground the conversation about the actual living conditions of the poor majority in the rural provinces, especially, but also the urban impoverished majority. So we have a luxury to ask the question, you know, down with the whole system, is you know, reform possible? I keep gravitating towards BLM co-founder Patrice Cullors' phrase of non-reformist reform, that, you know, that's a false dichotomy of revolution or reform. You got to have both. You got to have a non-reformist reform because people need to eat. People need to have the basic needs met. And because of the U.S. foreign policy, because that Haiti is caught in the crosshairs between two world superpowers of China and the United States over China's demanding that Haiti follow the one China policy. It's the last one of the last holdouts in the hemisphere, cutting off money to the United Nations, to be new, as Professor St. Paul said, that you have these multiple situations happening at once that I think, you know, I get the question, you know, does burn it all down? It's tempting to say that. And a lot of people will say that. And I think it's really important that we nuance, like, who's doing the talking, and, you know, people that are saying that are also in positions where they don't have to worry about their electricity. They have private generators with gas that they're paying for, and or people outside of the United States. Outside of Haiti right now. And what I'm hearing is that, you know, we got to have a much more, Haiti does need to have its sovereignty respected. There is a Montana Accord that was agreed on and published in August of 2021, a month after the assassination of President Moise. And yet, and still the Biden administration and its quote unquote core group allies, people that declare themselves to be, you know, having to be dealt with. They demand to have a seat at the table within Haitian political affairs. They don't support it. They don't support the active participation of 600 or so civil society organizations. I don't like the word civil society either, but, you know, it's the only roadmap that has that much, you know, peasant organizations, women organizations, LGBT organizations, voodoo organizations, Protestant organizations, human rights organizations, women's, you know, it's workers organizations. It's not perfect, not at all. But it is an articulation. It's a demand for respect for Haitian sovereignty. And the fact that the Biden administration continues to ignore it suggests that they just want the containment. Like Haiti can, you know, just stay in Haiti. But this is racial capitalism. You create the condition by which people need to leave, and then you say you have to stay. You know, it's a double standard. It's explicitly it's a continuation of the desire from the United States to snuff out the ideals of the Haitian Revolution that tout le monde est humain, everyone is human.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the ongoing crises in Haiti with Darlene Dubesson of the University of Pittsburgh, Mark Schuller of Northern Illinois University, and Jean-Eddie St. Paul of Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. And so the last question, sort of big question, actually, Professor St. Paul, you had a response to what Mark Schuller was saying.
I think there is a topic that we didn't touch on the show, and it is important. For instance, it was the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. And President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated, as you know, on July 7, 2021. In that assassination, there were Haitian American citizens involved, James Solage, Joseph Vincent, and Christian Emmanuel Sanon. There was a Colombian involved, German Rivera Garcia. And they used guns coming from the United States of America. They used the territory of the Dominican Republic. So, Doug, the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse is an assassination that responds to what we call in our field a transnational crime, okay, a transnational crime. And you know that Haiti does not manufacture guns. But when we are talking about, oh, the United Nations is exploring, you know, to send mission to Haiti. Biden is trying to help, you know, through the United Nations. But let me just read, for instance, let me read for you the way that the United Nations, the framework to attain a transnational crime is committed. For instance, on December 9, 1988, there was an ad hoc committee of the United Nations, and they adopted a resolution, the resolution 53/111. And that a resolution was called the Resolution Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime and the Protocol thereto. After that resolution was adopted on September 29, 2003, and 147 countries countries connected to the United Nations adopted that convention. And lastly, on July 26, 2018, a total of 190 countries signed that resolution against transnational crime. So why the United States of America is not using, or the United Nations is not using, the clause of that resolution to do the investigation to bring justice in the case of President Jovenel Moïse, knowing that the gun that killed President Jovenel Moïse came straight from the United States of America? So I don't see really that what Professor Schuller called the double standard. Definitely is a politic and policy of double standard that the U.S. has been, you know, promoting in Haiti. This is so the comment I wanted to make, connected to the treatment, the law that are written to deal with case of transnational organized crime. And the case of President Jovenel Moïse was a clear example of a transnational organized crime. And until now, nothing has happened.
And so, you know, certainly justice is essential. We've got about maybe 2-3 minutes left, but Darlene de Bousson, I wanted to give you a chance. We've been talking about what might be a resolution, or at least moving things in the right direction in Haiti. As you see these things being discussed and different types of interventions being discussed, what would you like to see happen in Haiti in response to the very specific crisis? Mark Schuller points out the number of people without electricity, without food, et cetera. And Jean-Eddie Saint-Paul talking about the importance of justice. What would you add to that list of the things that we need to address?
I guess instead of adding things to the list, what I'd like to do is propose an approach. So far, I think in this conversation, we've been talking about approaches as top down and bottom up in terms of, you know, this notion of the structure and agency and et cetera. And I am really thinking, is it possible, or how can we develop an approach that is at once intersectional and multiple strata? And what I mean by this is thinking about who is involved in the conversation about what to do about Haiti. That a lot of these conversations are happening far in away from those who understand the situation most. And we talk about, you know, the adage, if you will, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting the same result is the definition of insanity. It's also the definition of coloniality. That's how it works. And what it does is it proposes something else that reinscribes the same power structures under a new name. And it reinscribes its own logics, whether it is the Haitian state, as we talked about after, you know, in terms of the indemnities, or whether it is this sense of colonialism, neocolonialism, and the various ways in which we, interventions, crises, these kind of discourses that justify the reinscription of coloniality over and over again. So I'm thinking that this approach needs to be decolonial, and part of a decolonial approach talks about who is speaking, who is involved, what are the assumptions being made, and more importantly, does or how does this reinscribe the same power structures that created the problems we began with in the first place? I am skeptical about the sense of another intervention. I'm skeptical because every time there's an intervention, the discourse is, this crisis is like no other crisis we've seen before, over and over again. That's what justified the U.S. occupation the first time. That's what justified various coups, etc. And so every moment becomes this exceptional moment like no other, where we have to act. Boots need to be on the ground. I'm not saying not to act. I'm not saying that it is not exceptional. I guess what I'm thinking of is, how can we really understand the causes of this crisis as mirrored, intersecting systems operating at once?
That's a wonderful place to end. In thinking about the broad question, has it been that the international community has failed Haiti, or is the failure designed? And ultimately, although each of these cases is unique, the old line that history may not repeat itself, but unfortunately, it certainly rhymes. Thank you all very much. Our guests have been Darlene Dubasson, professor of anthropology at the University of Pittsburgh. She's the author of Haiti, Black Utopia, and We Know How to Work Together, Convite, Protest, and the Rejection of INGO Bureaucratic Dominance. Mark Schuller, presidential research professor and professor of anthropology and nonprofit and NGO studies at Northern Illinois University. He's the author of Humanitarian Aftershocks in Haiti and Killing with Kindness, Haiti, International Aid, and NGOs. And Jean-Eddie Sapon, professor of sociology at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. He's the author of Assassinations and Invasions, How the U.S. and France Shaped Haiti's Long History of Political Turmoil, and Between Two Worlds, Jean Pressmars, Haiti, and Africa. Thank you all very, very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.